Only in America.
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 This time, how evangelicals are urging governors to accept refugees in their communities, and how a national faith leader has made it his mission to advocate for immigration policies that respect the God-given dignity of every person.
The Catholic Church and evangelicals have been serving people around the world for generations and generations. We're the ones that have the rescue missions. We're the ones when there's Ebola in Africa. The last doctors to leave, those that stay, are the evangelical missionaries. This is what we do. This is who we are.
From the National Immigration Forum, I'm Ali Nirani. Welcome to Only in America. Over the last few weeks, more than 2,600 evangelical Christians have signed on to letters urging their governors to accept refugees and welcome them into their communities. Their action comes in response to President Trump's executive order this fall that requires state governors and local authorities to provide consent to resettling refugees. Without approval from the governors, the order could prevent many refugees from resettling in their family members' communities, even after being lawfully admitted into the country. Organized by World Relief and the Evangelical Immigration Table, the letters were sent to governors of 15 states. They wrote, "Evangelical churches and ministries have been active in serving newly arrived refugees for decades, and we pray you will not restrict the ability for us to love our global neighbors in this way." Over the last couple of months, I've seen this type of leadership from the Catholic Church, the Lutheran community, Church World Service, the IRC, the Jewish community organizations like HIAS, and so many others across religion and politics who have made it clear that Americans care about welcoming their neighbors who are fleeing persecution. And while there are a number of governors yet to decide, the letters and the civic activism that we've seen has been an inspirational outpouring of compassion as we bring 2019 to a close.
Support for the National Immigration Forum comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security. And from Humanity United. When humanity is united, we can bring a powerful force for human dignity.
My guest this week is the president of an association that represents more than 45,000 local churches. Furthermore, he is one of the kindest, smartest, funniest people I have met in the last decade. Leith Anderson is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, an association of evangelical denominations, organizations, schools, churches, and individuals. Serving 40 different denominations, the NAE serves a constituency of millions of churchgoers across the country. Leith has served as president of the NAE since 2006, and he's retiring at the end of 2019. During his tenure, Leith has led efforts to engage American evangelicals around shared values related to poverty relief, prison reform, immigration, and so much more. Before leading the NAE, Leith was the pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, where he still lives, when he's not traveling the world doing courageous work with his wonderful wife, Charlene. His work over the years with the NAE's humanitarian arm, World Relief, and the Evangelical Immigration Table have shown his commitment to upholding the humanity of immigrants and refugees and treating them with dignity. I've been fortunate enough to work with Leith over the years, and I have to say, it is always such a pleasure when I'm in a meeting or on a trip with him and his wife. And over the years, as I look back, there's so many things that I've learned from Leith. I guess I'll leave you with the top three lessons from Leith, and those are to be focused on your strategy, to be clear in your language, and to be humble in your manner.
At what point did you realize you wanted to become a pastor?
I'm going to give you too strange an answer, all right? The month I turned 15, I started dating this high school girl named Charlene, and she wanted to be a pastor's wife. And I hope that's not the only reason, and I hope God was involved in calling and all of that, but she was and is a huge influence in my life, as I consider her. My father was a pastor also.
Also, yes.
fit in the family tradition.
Okay, so you decided to become a pastor at 15, somewhere along
the way. Well, no, it was a later decision.
Right.
Went to college in Illinois and went to seminary in Colorado. I also have a doctorate in California, so sort of moved westward.
Mm-hmm. What was the first church you pastored?
I was a seminary student mm-hmm. in Denver and worked part-time in a church in Longmont, Colorado. And shortly after I graduated from seminary, the lead pastor of that church took another position. Mm-hmm. And at 24 years old, they asked me to succeed him, and I did, and was there 10 years.
So then you've done a lot of writing about kind of supporting young leaders and a lot of thinking about kind of how the church changes over time. And obviously a large part of that is around immigration and diversity. But being somebody who started at such a young age, how do you support young leadership also within the church?
It's a really good question, but I think it's such so varied. There's so many variables involved right here. One of the things I often, I've taught graduate students most of my life, so that's an opportunity to get to know people at critical junctures in their lives, and most of them are young. In doctoral programs, people often can be older. One of the things I often tell them to do is find mentors. I tell them the story of Camelot, mm-hmm. and if you've seen the movie or know the stage play.
I've seen the Monty Python version, does that count?
Well, that's... since it's an apocryphal story, it probably doesn't matter which version you see. But in it, King Arthur is in this terrible dilemma because his best friend, Sir Lancelot, has had an affair with the woman he loves, Queen Guinevere. And he wants to just forgive, and then maybe he should execute them for high treason. So he goes out into the forest, and he has this long conversation with Merlin, who is his mentor, Merlin the magician, and asks him for counsel on what he should do. And then you realize that in the storyline, Merlin has been dead for years. But he knew Merlin so well that he knew what Merlin would say to him in a situation that they had never discussed and Merlin had never been in. And I tell young leaders and potential leaders to have multiple mentors. They don't even have to be people that are alive. It could be somebody that lived 500 years ago, but get to know that person so well that when you face decisions that you never would have anticipated, you know what your mentor would say. And to have multiple mentors, you know, sort of like if you're going to invest money, you want to be in a mutual fund that has more than one stock. Mm-hmm. So that if a mentor turns out not to be helpful, you have alternatives.
So then in this day and age, or in this political moment where it is incredibly difficult to separate the politics of immigration from the people who are impacted by immigration. What's your counsel to pastors who are trying to help their congregations grapple with these changes?
It depends on where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I live in Minnesota. Minnesota has been largely a friendly destination for immigrants, especially refugees. So it's a little bit easier there than it is other places. And I think so much depends on your zip code, and many times people are familiar only with the circumstances of their zip code. So I would say to pastors and encourage them to say to people within their congregations, you need to get to know other people. Often the people whom we are most prejudiced or we dislike are people we don't even know. We've never met people. I think of actually an older man in the congregation where I was a pastor in Minnesota who he really had some deep-seated negative attitudes toward certain groups in the Middle East. We actually put together a trip for him and sent him to the Middle East, and he stayed in the home of someone whom he knew he disliked. And he came back, and in the church, he was a champion mm-hmm. for the people that previously he was an opponent of. And we just need to learn. Now, is there a risk to that? Of course there is, because it can go very wrong. It can go the other way as well. But, you know, the whole idea in Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan is the Samaritan was an outlier. He was someone that didn't fit into the culture and the religion of Jesus' people. And Jesus picked that as an example of someone whom you needed to get to know in mm-hmm. that man's circumstance.
How did you convince him to make that trip?
You know, he was retired. He had never traveled outside the United States. And it was sort of, got an idea for you.
Mm-hmm.
How if we help you? And I think he liked the adventure of going. He may not have chosen the same destination that we chose for him.
Uh-huh.
I wish all stories turned out that well. They don't all turn out that well. But it really turned out well.
Mm-hmm. So in 2007, I think when you were interim president of the National Association of Evangelicals, you had said that you saw immigration reform as an issue that needed to be resolved. And I think you expressed some enthusiasm, effort for the organization to engage. At what point in your career did you realize that the church had a role in policy change and advocating for policy change, with specifically with regards to immigration?
Well, as an evangelical, my commitment is that I take the Bible seriously and follow Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. So I didn't begin with immigration. I began with the Bible. And the Bible is a book with lots of immigrants, from the Old Testament people of Israel to Jesus going from Bethlehem to Egypt. There are multiple stories. And so I knew what it said, and then it was seeking, and continues to be, applying what the Bible says to the immediate circumstance, because the circumstances change, but the biblical story is old.
So then how do you, kind of going back to the question of, working with pastors, there is an issue, okay, zip code is important, but then there's also, I've seen the polling that NAE's done around the influence of the political media on congregants when it comes to issues like immigration. So does it feel like sometimes you are kind of bucking up the confidence of pastors to be able to have these conversations?
There's an underlying principle on several things here. And I would say my underlying principle, which I think is an underlying biblical principle, is that you need to get to know the other person. You need to get to know your context. So different parts of the Bible are written originally in different languages because they were in different contexts. And so when it comes to immigration, understanding the people and starting with what are their needs and who they are, and then how we can best serve them is really important. But the same thing is true for a pastor. And honestly, for most pastors, immigration is not their first issue. The word pastor means shepherd. They're to be a shepherd to their congregation. They need to serve their people. They need to love them. They need to teach them the Bible. They need to educate them in their faith. And that is a first priority. Not immigration, and not many of the other issues which sometimes are identified with pastors and churches. So what I would seek to do, both with congregations and with pastors, is begin with that context and say, out of your understanding of the Bible, out of your care for people, out of what you're doing in this congregation, how does that then reach over to touch the lives of other people who may not be here? And at least within our tradition, there has been a long history of sending missionaries all over the world, missionaries who have started colleges and established hospitals and written unwritten languages, all kinds of things. So how do we live that out in our generation in this circumstance?
You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday, kind of a leading CEO of one of the social media companies, and I told him that story of, the involvement of evangelical churches in refugee resettlement, and he was stunned. He did not realize that for evangelical America, that the refugee resettlement is a point of entry to immigration in many ways. Do you think that's changing? I mean, as people are coming up through the church and, with the refugee cap numbers dwindling, do you worry that people are losing that connection to refugees?
Well, some are, but the National Association of Evangelicals is related to World Relief. World Relief is one of nine agencies. They're called VOLAGs, volunteer agencies. And legally, you can bring refugees into the country only through those one of those nine agencies. So we have been doing this for a very long period of time. And regardless of people's religious or ethnic background or where they originated, churches have been a central point of volunteers. And there have been more churches and more people volunteering than there have been refugees available to take advantage of that. So that hasn't changed. There are plenty who are waiting to help, and they're anxious to help. And they meet people at the plane. They find an apartment for them. They look for jobs. They get furniture. They do wonderful things. So that hasn't changed. Are there others that have or never got engaged? Well, of course.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing talking to the people who have done that.
They love it.
Their lives are changed.
Absolutely love it. You know, in Wooddale Church, where I was the pastor, I remember a flight attendant who said, well, I'll try this once. And up until that time, her life, her definition was that she was a flight attendant. Well, then she became involved in resettling refugees. Flight attendant was part of what she did, but what she really did was welcome people to this country and help them and encourage them and bless them.
When I talk to folks who've gone through that experience, they love telling those stories because not everybody can have that experience.
And they become their friends. I want to go a step beyond. For some, they become their family.
Yeah. It is pretty remarkable. And then, you know, kind of the expansion from refugee resettlement to understanding trafficking issues and people's, their perception of the world changes. And they don't have to leave their city.
Yeah, trafficking is a huge, huge, difficult issue. Yeah. So I was on President Obama's advisory council. And during my tenure there, trafficking was our primary emphasis. And we hosted a national conference. We brought in a lot of experts on trafficking. And, you know, the large segments are child soldiers, and then workers, and then sex trafficking. And one of the things that came up, which I thought was really interesting, is where are the places that a girl who is trafficked, where is a safe place where you can communicate with her? One of the things I learned was that two examples were cited. One is in a women's bathroom stall. So information that you put on the back of the door is information that you can get to her that you couldn't get to her any other time. And the other is a church service, because girls that are trafficked will be allowed to go and visit a church. And, you know, and when I tell that to people, they don't think that maybe they are the one safe place that someone who is trafficked can find security and help.
And you know, I was in Honduras, and the same point was brought up. The church was one of the only places that somebody who was looking to get away from a gang could go.
Yeah, I was in Honduras earlier this year with World Vision, and churches, and along the border, churches, actually right now they're kind of overwhelmed because the needs far exceed their resources.
It's really amazing what the churches are doing throughout Latin America these days.
Yeah, they step up and do what they have to do. Yeah. And did they see this as their primary calling 25 years ago? They probably didn't. Mm-hmm. But they lived out the gospel of Jesus Christ in the context of the challenges that they're facing. Good for them.
Yeah. As a share a story really quickly. I was in Ciudad Juarez a couple weeks ago, and the pastor of El Buen Pastor Church, he told us he stepped into the role not expecting to run a shelter that was serving 100, 200 people a night. And his shelter had people from around the world who are literally stranded in Mexico right now. But he and his small team of three or four people, they just kept it going.
Yeah, I think we often assume that all who seek to cross the southern border are coming from Latin America, and so many are not. It is the gateway they seek.
How does immigration play out for the church over the next 30, 40 years?
Well, back to the Bible and the Old Testament, if you claim to be a prophet and you got it wrong, you risk being stoned to death because you were speaking for yourself when you were supposed to be speaking for God. So I'm very cautious about predicting what's going to happen in the next 30 to 40 years. The real answer is I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that we will see in this period of polarization that just as there is polarization from zip code to zip code, from north to south, from east to west, there is polarization within churches, and that will continue. It's not new, but it will continue on this issue. So what I would choose to do is go where the greatest promise exists and seek those opportunities rather than try to persuade everyone who may disagree that they need to engage. I would challenge them that then they need to find where they can engage on some other issue if they can't engage on this one. And I have enough confidence that there are enough churches and enough people in those churches that they will step up and do what needs to be done.
So I have a potentially kind of strange question for you, if this isn't strange enough already. When it comes to immigration, I think many folks who are outside of the church, they have assumptions about evangelicals and immigration. So what would you like to see from the secular community in the United States with respect to evangelical America and immigration?
It'll be helpful to understand that evangelicals are not a monolith, that there are, as one friend of mine says, there are many evangelicalisms in America. And just as there are different reflections in churches that are African-American or Caucasian or Hispanic, that are all evangelical churches, but there are differences within them. So don't assume that all evangelicals are the same. Figure out which ones you're talking about, which ones are politicized and which ones are not politicized. I mean, that's the fair and the right thing to do.
I completely agree, obviously. But I also feel like immigration is one of the issues that potentially could help also kind of heal the divide in the country between evangelicals and folks who are not evangelical. I really think that that's a big part of the... There's a growing polarization there as well that we, I think, as a country really struggle to kind of to get beyond, because it feels like everything's politicized.
Yeah, I don't know a cure to that.
Yeah.
And I also know that those who are on the extremes, the poles of the polarization, can say dramatic things that sometimes deepen the divide. I'll give you an example of something that I find troubling. I don't know what to do about it. But there have been several anti-immigrant blogs and organizations that say the reason that the Catholic Church and evangelicals are pro-immigration is because we have declining numbers and we want to fill up the seats and the receipts with immigrants. That could not be farther from the truth. Mm-hmm. Understand that the Catholic Church and evangelicals have been serving people around the world for generations and generations. We're the ones that have the rescue missions. We're the ones when there's Ebola in Africa. The last doctors to leave, those that stay, are the evangelical missionaries. This is what we do. This is who we are. And then to send out a message that says, oh, no, we're pro-immigration because of what we can get out of it, I mean, that's just not fair. But that adds to the size of the Grand Canyon that people have in their perceptions. Mm-hmm. So what we do is, to quote from the New Testament, is you speak the truth in love, and you hope that you have a responsive audience to listen to what that message is.
So what are you doing to celebrate Ethiopian New Year this week?
Well, I'm riding in Uber with just a delight. This guy, he told me his story. He told me his training in Ethiopia, how to get licensure here, how much he's paid. He wants to move to Iowa. He drove 16 hours for a job interview in Iowa.
Why does he want to move to Iowa?
He wants to move to Iowa because he can rent a two-bedroom place for $500 a month. And in Washington, he can't afford that.
Yeah.
He wants to have a good and better life.
Yeah. Last question for you. Name of the podcast is Only in America. So just to finish this sentence, Only in America, ..
Only in America do we have the diversity and the welcome that no other country has ever experienced before. So we have an opportunity to set an example for the rest of the world and for the rest of history.
Well, thank you, Lethan. I have to say that over the years that we've had the opportunities to work together and I've had the chances to learn from you directly or indirectly, I hope you don't mind if I refer to you as one of my mentors.
Oh, wow. I love that. Thank you.
Leith Anderson is the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. You can find more information on Leith at our website, immigrationforum.org/podcast. While you're there, subscribe to Only in America to stay up to date when new episodes are released. We're going to take a break until the new year. Stay tuned for more content that we're looking forward to bringing you starting in mid-January. Thank you so much for listening to Only in America this year. Our work at the National Immigration Forum is about redefining the immigration conversation. And through our podcast, we're hoping that we're doing just that. Two seasons and more than 100 episodes in, your support is helping reshape our nation's immigration story. As we approach the end of the year, please consider supporting the forum at immigrationforum.org. Only in America is produced and edited by Emily Chow, Joanna Taylor, and Megan Wetmore. I'm Ali Nirani. Have a wonderful Christmas and a happy new year, and I will talk to you in 2020.